And welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, Paul Winkler. Tell him I got a laugh in my voice. I got some things to share with you. This show about investing from perspective of somebody that doesn't get paid by the investment firm, so it may sound a little different from what you typically hear. Because a lot of times, you know, the investing firms and the investment advisors, and I'm telling you, I was one of them for a long time, worked for the big investment firm, didn't realize that I was just parroting their marketing message quite often. You know, you go to these meetings, you learn about investing, and you just don't realize you're learning about marketing and you're learning about, you know, what appeals to the investor, and you're just learning how to get people to buy the stuff that your investment firm sells. And, you know, that was just one of the frustrations, one of the many frustrations that I had working for the big investment firm and all the people that work with me. We come from the same frame, the same standpoint, really, gets down to it. Okay, so I've got something I want to share with you today. I've talked a little bit about this before. This I thought was very, very interesting and I think instructive. You know, because I think if you get a little bit of the behind the scenes when it comes to investing, you can become a much, much more successful investor. Investors have all kinds of biases, you know, these psychological biases that they go through, and it's really hard to ferret through what's real and what's not real when it comes to investing, because you're just bombarded with so much garbage all the time. You know, watch TV. And then they'll, you know, they got all the newest products out there, and you know, you can buy this ETF and it's hedged against the yen. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? You know, you get another investment that's actually engaging in some leverage and trying to increase returns that way. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? You know, and then you get all of a sudden, you know, maybe there's another investment that is religiously conscious investing. That was something that somebody asked me about this week. And I said, you better watch out for that kind of stuff, because in reality, there is no way to avoid sin. There is no way to avoid bad dealings. There is no way to avoid companies that don't do anything. Now, you can look at the things that are really super, super obvious. But, you know, the reality of it is that those companies that are doing things that are super obviously bad are not typically that big, really, when it gets down to it. Now, you may be able to point to a couple things because you have pet things that you really don't like. You know, like, for example, people don't like petroleum products and oil and those types of industries. But, you know, there may be people that really, really like, you know, solar panels. And I did a thing on talking about, you know, solar energy and how these solar panels are actually taken apart by people in third world countries. And it's really dangerous. It's really bad for them. And you think, well, wait a minute, there's something wrong with that, isn't there? You know, going and pawning off these dangerous things to be taken apart and dismantled in countries and actually harming people in third world countries, maybe we ought to be concerned about that too. So you just see that there's so many different moving parts to this. It's really, really challenging to say, I'm going to avoid all anything that's bad, anything that appears to be bad, I'm going to avoid it. There's just no doing it. Well, that is related to this piece that I saw in investment news this week, and I thought it'd be instructive to walk through this. Okay, so when we invest, of course, what we're trying to get is higher returns. But a big thing that people are trying to do now, especially younger people, is I want to make a difference. And that's laudable. That's good. Yeah, we ought to go through the world and go, how can I make the world a better place? And sometimes it's a little bit misguided, you know, simply because, you know, how do you make the world a better place is the question you have to ask yourself. Am I actually, with what I'm doing, is that actually happening, or is it likely to happen? And it's interesting, you look at studies of younger people when they reach their late 20s, and they start to realize that maybe some of the things that they chased after their entire lives to make the world a better place are actually things that don't work or won't make the world a better place. And there's actually documented a higher level of depression when people reach that conclusion that maybe they've been chasing their tail or chasing after the wrong thing. And, you know, so, and then they have to reevaluate their lives. And that's a hard thing. It's hard to go through and reevaluate and go, well, wait a minute, I lived all these years and I was chasing after something and it was the wrong thing. You know, so you got to really think about those types of things. And it can be confusing when you go out there. And I did a piece a little while back where it was actually talking about nuclear energy. And, you know, you get a lot of people say, it's, oh, it's bad, it's dangerous, terrible, Three Mile Island and all that stuff. And this guy was saying, if you look at the safety record, it's unbelievably high compared to other types of energy. And yet it's being demonized. And you know, you go, well, wait a minute, maybe that's the right thing we ought to be doing. Maybe we ought to be. It's a fascinating, fascinating video on it out there. And I can't remember the name of it, but it was a TED Talk, I think, this guy was doing. If you get a chance, you know, you might want to go out there and look at TED Talks out on YouTube and look up where is nuclear energy and green energy and the problems with it or something like that. You'd probably be able to find it. But, you know, this piece in investment news was SRI portfolio. So socially responsible portfolios is what that stands for. And how they shine at robo-advisors. Now, robo-advisor is where you have a robot managing your portfolio. I'm a robot and I'm here to manage your investment portfolio and I'm going to do a really great job and I'm going to be really cheap, but I'm going to be looking just like any other target date fund is the reality of it. But no, just never mind that. You know, target date funds are something I pick on routinely here and they've been around forever, where the fund company just puts it together and manages it. And it's just the latest gimmick out there. Robo-advised portfolios, you know, some of the things that they do to make money are just hidden from sight. You don't even see, you know, some of the things that they do to make money. But since most people just think, hey, it's a robot, it's good. And it means that somehow they're going to reduce costs. And the reality of it is not so much. But anyway, that's a topic for another time. But they're saying here that the portfolios are shining at robo-advisors. And this is instructive because it tells you a lot about human behavior and it shows you what investment advisors are being taught. Okay, so it says socially responsible portfolios offered by several digital advisors are outperforming their standard counterparts, according to a new report by a research firm, Backend Benchmarking. I love that name, Backend. They're going to make back ends of themselves on this one. But anyway, they looked at six socially responsible investing portfolios. Now, I've done shows on socially responsible investing, and it isn't pretty. You know, if you look at the data, the long-term data, it's not pretty. But I'll continue with this, and I'll come back to that. They looked at six socially responsible investing portfolios opened at a robo-advisor with at least a year of performance data. Now, number one, you ought to just go, what? Are you kidding me? 1 year of data, and you're making a decision on something? I mean, it'd be like going, I am going to make a decision on somebody's performance at the craps table based on one bet that they made. You know, it's just, oh, you know, that slot machine. Hey, look, she went up to the slot machine and she actually pulled the lever and she made money. Or he made money. I don't want to be sexist here. Oh, man, you must be really good at that slot machine. You know, you made money on the first pull. You know, what about blind random luck? You know, you look at when you're betting in the stock market, and that's literally what these people are doing. You know, you're basically gambling as to whether you're going to capture the right area of the market or something like that. And the reality of it is, we look at that as skill. Well, if it were really skill, the outperformance, we would find active managers and professional managers of funds beating the market on a routine basis. And we look at the 15-year data, I've talked about this before, but it's 92% of professional managers fail to match the market return, 97% for small companies. And, you know, the reality of it is that it's not getting done. So it must be random luck if they beat. Now, so number one, 1 year doesn't tell you anything. You know, one study I've talked about before, but it goes something like 80 years to find out if somebody has actually outperformed. And, you know, some studies show like 65 years or something like that. But it takes that amount of time to tell whether somebody's outperformance was due to skill or luck, either dead or retired by them. So number one, that's the first thing that's silly. 1 year of performance data. Of those, four have performed better than the standard portfolio offered by the same robo. Wait a minute. It's the same investment manager, and four of them performed better. That same robo, do they have skill in that area and they don't have skill in the other area? I mean, what's the deal here? Oh, no, wait a minute. They're trying to tell us that SRI portfolios are better, that somehow they perform better, and they're actually a superior way of investing. That's the marketing shtick. That is some superior way of investing. Now, on the show, I've gone back and I've looked at 5 and 10 year periods, and I've shown that the SRI portfolios don't outperform. Matter of fact, significantly have underperformed historically. So is it because of this strategy that this is better for some reason? Well, let me read on. They're offered by Wealthsimple and Morgan Stanley Digital Advisor. Access Investing performed exceptionally well, beating their prospective standard offerings by more than 2% in the trailing 1 year period. Now you go, okay, so why? What's going on? Well, for socially responsible portfolios to outperform, they must overcome the increasing cost of the underlying funds, said David Goldstone. So right there, there is something that tells you a little bit about what's going on. Investment companies right now are struggling, folks. They're struggling terribly because they're getting squeezed on costs. And what's happening is they're going, oh, crud, what are we going to do? Or, you know, they're having to reduce management fees. Well, we can hide some stuff. We can't hide everything, but we can hide some things. Oh, wait a minute. We got a better idea. We can come up with something that people think that they really want or think that they really need. And let's make them think that they're actually doing good with their investments. Let's make them think that they're actually making a difference in the world because they want to make a difference in the world, and all the other stuff that they tried before didn't work. So let's try this now. Maybe this will work. Now, the reality of it is when you're buying stock, what are you doing? You're buying it off of some other schlep that's got it. You know, so the reality of it is you're not helping the company. You know, the money that helped the company was in the initial public offering, the IPO. That was when the company first got money. That's when they're helped. Because you're buying their stock and the money's going directly to them. Otherwise, it's going to somebody else that owns the company. So when I buy stock, you know, there's somebody else somewhere else in the world that is selling that same stock. It's not going to the company. Okay, so number one, that's just a misunderstanding there that you're helping the company with this socially responsible investing. But it may make you feel better, so. Maybe there's some benefit to that. But anyway, so it's, although 1 year is a relatively short period to judge. Oh, because hang on. I want to make the rest of this point here. I get so ADD, it's not even funny. So if we look at this, you say, oh, they've got to overcome the increase in cost in the underlying funds. Ah, we've got something that we can make people feel better, and they're willing to pay for feeling better about themselves, so we can charge more for these things. We can justify the cost because we're hiring a manager to find companies that are actually socially responsible. And we can say we went and dug down and found all the companies that are socially responsible. And a point I've made on this show as well many times before is you look at the holdings of these portfolios, the funds or the stocks actually inside these funds. And you see, a lot of times, a big part of the holdings are finance companies and investing companies and companies in the financial sector, which I have spent 18 years of my life on this radio show showing you all the dysfunction in that industry. Well, you know, maybe that's not as socially responsible because it's hurting society. I don't know. I'm thinking maybe something like that. So although 1 year is a relatively short period of time to judge long-term trends, it's not relatively short. It is incredibly short. You know, I want decades, decades upon decades when I judge something. You know, when you look at the data on academic research on investing, you know, small caps versus large caps, value versus growth, international versus U.S., they're not looking at 10 years. They're not looking at 1 year, 5 years. They're not looking at 10 years. They're looking at 20, 30. And you say, I don't have 20 or 30 years. Well, if you're in your 60s, you very well might have 20, 30, even 40 years. People are living a lot longer, but you're looking at longer periods of time simply just because you're trying to see if there is a story behind it, as an academic would put it. In other words, is there a reason? Why? Why do small companies outperform large companies over long periods of time? You know, why? What's going on there? Is there a valid academic sensible reason for that to happen? And yeah, the answer is yeah. Just think about it. If you're loaning money to a smaller company, you're going to charge them more interest because of the fact that there's more risk. And some people think it's the other way. It's, who would I charge more interest to, a small company or a large company? And some people will say large. And you go, why? And they go, well, because they can afford it. Ah, no way. It's the other way around. You know, the reality of it is if you're really big and you're really stable, you don't need my money. So you're not going to pay much for it because you don't need it. You know, it's really wealthy people and people that have lots of cash that hardly pay anything on interest if they borrow money. Why? Because they really don't need it. And the company lending them money isn't worried about getting their money back. You know, so the reality of it is they can't charge them much money. Now, we want to look at lots of data for that reason. Now, it says here, although the one-year period is a relatively short period to judge their trends, the comparable performance of SRI portfolios is a positive sign for this investing trend. So they're already documenting it as a positive sign somehow that this is actually good. And it says, if it is shown that investors do not pay a performance premium to consider environmental, social, and governance factors. And the reality is that they have been paying a premium historically in this area, but they're only looking at 1 year here. In other words, they're not making as much money in English. The researchers attributed the outperformance. This is the part that I really love. The researchers attributed the outperformance of Morgan Stanley's SRI portfolio to much lower international allocation. Bingo. Now we finally got to it. And after this break, I'm going to talk about what got to what. What does that mean? What's the big deal there? Why is that important? Why is that line so important? Stay tuned. I'll talk about that just after this. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Coaching Show, Paul Winkler, paulwinkler.com, podcast. Download that. So, in news, Secure Act debate in Senate derails vote. Debate over setting every community up for retirement enhancement. Setting every community. Who comes up with these acronyms? I didn't even know what SECURE stood for until now. I didn't realize it was an acronym. I just saw that. Hit a snag on the Senate floor Thursday, ending without a vote. So basically, it's on hold right now. And, you know, if you read things about it, I've talked about this a little bit, you know, that they were threatening the stretch IRA. So if you inherited an IRA, you inherit it and you're not a spouse, you can stretch it. So let's say if you have an IRA and you have, you know, maybe your 30-year-old son inherits it or something like that. And they look at your 30-year-old son and they say, well, life expectancy for your 30-year-old son is 50 years. Then what they'll do is they'll take the account value and they'll divide it by, you know, you pass away, goes to them. And then they take the account value at the end of the year after the year of death. And then they say, okay, account value divided by 50 equals how much money you have to take out of it. So 2%, you know, $100,000 account divided by 50 is $2,000. 2% of the account is what comes out and goes to your son that year. Next year, they divide the account value, whatever it ends up, whatever the year ends up at, and they divide it by 49 because, you know, 1 year has elapsed. And then they divide it by 48 and 47, 46, 45, you know, they continually go down. So the percentage of the account value goes up. You know, eventually you get to 25-year life with life expectancy. Now you're taking out, account value divided by 25. So, you know, 4% now. You've doubled the amount of money coming out. And then it increases even faster after that, obviously. You get down to 10-year life expectancy and divided by 10, that's 10% of the account value. Now, what they're looking at, they were actually threatening this. They were looking at changing it so that you would have to take out the money much faster if you inherited an IRA. So that's part of what's going away. The other thing, well, that's part of what could go away if it ever comes back and is actually implemented. Let's just put it that way. So the issue really gets down to, you know, what else is not going to happen? Because of that, one of the parts of the bill that was actually, I kind of liked the idea in the bill, was raising the RMD age to 72. You know, right now it's 70 and a half. Whoever came up with 70 and a half, I have no clue. And there were some other pieces of the legislation. They were talking about making it easier for smaller businesses to set up 401ks. Yeah, because sometimes it can get kind of expensive. And I don't know if that was going to help with expense, but hopefully it would. The other thing was giving a tax credit to for employers who set up plans with automatic enrollment, which I, you know, just talking about how helpful that is getting people to actually participate. And then the other thing that they talked about, which I wasn't so hot on, and you know, business owners weren't so hot on it either, as I've talked about in previous shows, were adding annuities. Because, you know, you take an annuity and you begin retirement, you start getting an income, and you go, hey, you know what? I can live off of this amount of income. This is pretty cool. I can live off of this. You get down the road for 10 years and the purchasing power of the dollar has dropped, and 20 years and it's dropped even more. And, you know, you're getting up there in age and all of a sudden your medical expenses are starting to creep in and you've got a lot more expenses in that area and your money just doesn't go as far as it used to. PaulWinkler.com. PaulWinkler.com is the website. Check that out. This is the Investor Coaching Show on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler, talk about the world of money and investing. PaulWinkler.com is the website, and you get the podcast there. You go to the website and grab the podcast. No matter what format that you've got, you can go check that out right there on the website. And if you've missed segments, of course, you can pull those all up. So, and you know, the video's there too. So that's PaulWinkler.com is the website. And of course, if you want to go, hey, I want to find out more about what these guys do, there's all kinds of stuff on there that tells you about what we do and even setting up meetings if you want to come out to any one of our offices around town. We're scattered all over the place. So let's see. So SRI portfolios, socially responsible portfolios, very gimmicky in my humble opinion, as well as the religiously conscious portfolios, very gimmicky. It's a lot about sales in this industry, and you got to watch out because, you know, it's whatever you'll buy. I mean, that's literally, and you know, that time, I'm not saying that the advisors necessarily are trying to trick you or anything like that. They actually believe in it too. And typically, when I was an investment advisor working for a big firm, some of the studies that we talked about were actually mischaracterized. And that's what this next line that I was just referring to before the break is really getting at. Says researchers attributed to the outperformance of Morgan Stanley's SRI portfolio, socially responsible, if you're just joining us, talking about how great socially responsible portfolios have done over 1 year. Versus the robo-advisors. That's great. Yeah, 1 year, that's just a lot of data. So what? You know, if you look at any given year, you'll find 1 year large U.S. stocks do the best, and then international large will do great the next year. And after that, the year after that, it'll be emerging markets, small companies. And the year after that, it's emerging markets, small value companies. And then the year after that, it will be international small value companies. Then it'll be government bonds the year after that because everything in the market goes down or something. You know, it's always something different. You know, so to look at 1 year is absolutely silly because it constantly moves. And if you really get down to it, you at a country level, oh my goodness, you ought to see how it jumps around. You know, 1 year it'll be Germany does really well, then it'll be France that'll do really well, and then it'll be, you know, Spanish companies that'll do great, and then Japanese companies, and Australia will be tops, and then Finland will be the top after that, and the next year it'll be Sweden, and the next year it'll be Canada. You know, Canadian stocks have the best returns the year after that. And I remember back when, and it wasn't that long after that whole Greece mess happened. And no, not in the kitchen, Greece, the country. So when you looked at Greece, it actually had great performance, a phenomenal, unbelievable performance after the big mess. And I made a point when that whole thing in Greece was happening, going down with all the debt issues and all the things that people were concerned about. I just said, you know, look, you got to realize that this kind of stuff happens, and they're going to try to figure out a way to get out of this, and everybody's just having a panic attack over this. And, you know, a couple of years later, it was one of the top performing areas of the market. I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was unbelievably high returns. And yet people had completely written the country. Not that I have a lot of money in Greece. I really don't. But just the point being, you know, you don't want to go and bet too much on a country with any one country, you know, really gets down to it. And especially a country that's more of an emerging market country and a struggling emerging market country at that. But it says here in this article, it says researchers attributed the outperformance of Morgan Stanley's SRI portfolio to much lower international allocation. There you go. There is your sign right there on what's going on. So if we look at the last year, we would certainly see that international markets did not do as well as U.S. markets. And that brings us back to the study that I was taught as a broker. Three academics, Brinson, Hood, and Bebauer. And what they were actually doing is studying pension plans. What they want to know is why different pension plans had different returns over the same period in time. You know, you look at a single year, for example, and you go, well, wait a minute, this pension had an 8% return, and this one had a 12% return. Why was this return 4% higher than their return? And you go, well, was it due to superior stock selection? Well, you know, what you could look at other years and see if they had outperformance due to that reason. You could look at the, you know, market timing. Maybe that their performance in the area of market timing was superior. Maybe they were just better at foreseeing trends and responding to them. Well, you know, how do you judge that? Well, it's the same managers. Let's look at how they did in other areas in other years and see if it is a consistent thing that they seem to have a greater prowess when it comes to determining what areas of the market are going to perform better. Let's look at that. You know, maybe they're better at reading tea leaves. Maybe they're better at reading what's going on in Washington. Maybe they're better at, you know, looking at economic trends. Maybe they're better at looking at social trends. You know what? Why do they have better performance? Well, they found that overwhelmingly, and the first time they did the study, it was 94%. The second time the study was done, it was 91.5%. of the difference in performance was due to asset allocation, how the portfolio was divided between different areas of the market. So if we look at how much money they have in small companies, well, if you were overweighted in small companies in the past year, you would have had underperformance, small U.S. companies even. You know, if you were overweighted in value, your performance wouldn't have been. Now, in recent months, you know, small has done much better, you know, than large even. And you'll have single days. I mean, good grief. I remember one day, I think it was last week or something like that. Small companies actually outperformed large. They tripled the performance. And it was significant. You know, so you can have days and weeks and months where one area of the market does better than others. And then all of a sudden it changes in a blink of an eye and you don't even have any warning whatsoever. You have no clue it's going to happen. Because market doesn't go and send you a note and go, hey, Mike, you know, this today is going to be this area of the market's going to rock and roll, and you just need to make sure that you're there. And the market doesn't do that. You know, it just, we don't get this little note from God saying that this is all of a sudden going to be the area of the market that just rocks and does phenomenal, and you need to, you know, be in it. But, you know, so we look at this and say, well, what's driving performance? Asset mix. Well, what did they have less of in the outperforming portfolios? They had international less. And so, you know, they're basically attributing it to somehow, and it's in top news, in investment news. It's top news that these portfolios are shining. And, you know, the investment community looks at the wrong things. They're looking at it going, the top performance is because of somehow or other SRI is superior. Socially responsible investing is somehow a better thing to be doing. When in reality, it was an allocation thing, and we can go back to 1986. We can go back to 1986 and look at that study that tells us that's what it is. And it's just, to me, silliness. Absolute silliness. And it's just, it's a shame because the public has no idea that it is just a marketing thing. And that's basically what it is. It's just a marketing thing. I'm Paul Winkler. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show. Yeah, just don't pay attention to this stuff. You know, it's, you know, just be aware. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. All right. Investor Coaching Show. PaulWinkler.com is the website that you can check out for all podcasts. Info for signing up and subscribing to the podcast, and also even the video feeds. You can subscribe to those things as we update those videos on a regular basis to make sure that you stay up to speed on things going on. There was an article entitled that I wanted to cover because I disagree with, again, written to financial advisors. A lot of times I'll bring you things that are written to financial advisors because I want you to see what advisors are reading and just hear the other side of it, because a lot of people espouse this, and I've been to many 401k meetings where I hear this stuff and I go, it's not exactly right. But I'm not just going to tell you it's just not right. I'm going to tell you why I disagree with it. Financial wellness, better off getting back to basics. So the thing that they got into here, which I do agree with, is the auto-enrollment idea. And I've had some people that do this, and I think it's great. I have a client of mine, and every year what she does is she goes and increases her contribution to her 401k by 1% per year, and she has it automatically done, which I think is kind of nice. So, you know, 1 year she'll be 1%, and then 2 years, and second year she'll be 2%. Now, she probably started off at the full match, so... You know, a lot of times you'll have a company will match your contributions up to, let's say, 4%. You know, sometimes it's 5%. It's just, it depends on their plan document, you know, as to what they're going to match. But, you know, you might have 100% up to 3% and 50% of the next two. So you got matches going up to 5% or 100% up to 4%. You know, so there are all kinds of different formulas. You know, so maybe, and this would be a good idea, go up to the match. Whatever they're going to give you a match on, if they're going to match, you know, at least 5%, don't give up that money. It's free money. And, you know, the reality is if you'll just do that with your budget, you'll figure it out, is kind of what I find with people, is they figure it out. They figure out how to handle their finances. It's like getting a pay cut of 5%. You know, it's not going to kill you. Now, if you got a pay cut of 100% because you lost your job completely, it might be a big deal. But a pay cut of 5% is probably not going to be a make or break thing in your life. So you do that, and then what you'll do is every year you increase it by 1%, and voila, before long you're at 10, 15% of your pay. That's what you're saving. You know, it's a good idea, and you know, that's what they talk about here. Then they say automatic enrollment uses the inertia of retirement savers to their advantage. And there was Vanguard Group data. They found that they had 52% higher participation rates than those with voluntary enrollment. Significant since, according to their data, plan participant in the broadest metric for gauging 401k plan performance. So, you know, you want to get people putting money away, and the best way to do it is just automatically enroll them, because they're not going to go in there and unenroll. I mean, it just, people don't do that. They're just like, ugh. Yeah, I probably should save. I'm not going to go to the office. And it's embarrassing to go to the office and say, hey, can you stop taking money and putting in a 401k from you? Because it makes it look like you're maybe irresponsible and you don't have your stuff together and you're not able to save. And people want to primarily look good in life. So that doesn't bode well, you know. So it's much easier to just let it ride, right? It says there's a small... There's also a large disparity between large and small plans. About 70% of plans with at least 5,000 participants use auto-enrollment. So it's the bigger companies that are doing this kind of stuff. Smaller companies aren't doing it as much. And because they're maybe a cost involved or something like that. Additionally, Record Keeper's data suggests many investors are misusing target date funds and perhaps diminishing their investment returns as a result. Now, it says, here's what they find. 1 in 10 target date investors have invested in more than one target date fund in their plan. Now, that doesn't make any sense. You don't want to do that. And the reason is because a target date fund will own, typically if it's the same fund company, and they normally are. So let's say that if it's the Vanguard target date fund, you know, and you're using the target date 2040 fund, well, it's going to hold five funds. One is the biggest holding will be large U.S. As it's a total U.S. market portfolio, but it mainly holds large U.S. stocks because it's not really well diversified. And then you'll have the next biggest holding will be the large international or total international, which is primarily holding large international stocks. Again, not great diversification because big U.S. companies and big international, they just tend to move with each other. So I'm not a big fan of those funds for that reason. And, you know, it's not just them. It's Fidelity does it that way. T. Rowe Price does it that way. All the fund companies, John Hancock, they all do that. You know, they're primarily holding what you're familiar with because that's your bias. You know, we have biases toward the familiar. We're humans. That's the way we are. And fund companies go, hey, you know, rather than educate these investors a lot, let's just go with their humanity. And and if we all do the same thing, nobody's going to sue us. It's reality. So if we look at the portfolio, it's those two, and the next biggest one might be like a total bond portfolio, and there might be a cash portfolio or something like that. Well, the difference between the 2040 fund and a 2030 fund will be primarily how much do they hold. Like, for example, a longer-term portfolio might be 75% stocks and 25% bonds, which is, you know, for a longer-term investor, you know, 75, maybe it might be 90%. And, you know, typically, I don't find the target date funds go quite that far out on stocks. They like holding bonds because I guess it's easier to keep people disciplined when you're not educating them and keep them more disciplined if there's less up and down with the market in their portfolio. Now, which you would have more with stocks, and you have more risk, more historically, more return, right? Now, if we look at a 2020 portfolio, for example, if you're retiring next year, then you're going to find that there's going to be a lot more in bonds. You might have, you know, 40, 50%. Sometimes the fund companies go overboard. They put too much in bonds, in my humble opinion. And because everybody's different, you just got different financial situations, but yet they have the same mix for everybody that's retiring in that year, that's another problem I have with target date funds. It's just one size fits all, and one size doesn't fit anybody very well, is really what ends up happening. But if you look at the mix, you say, okay, well, this portfolio, let's just say the 2040 portfolio is 75% stocks. The 2020 portfolio might be 50% stocks. Well, it's the same exact stocks, the same exact funds, the total market portfolio and the total international. It's the same exact stuff, but it just has less of it in the short-term portfolio, the 2020 portfolio. It just has less stocks. So you're just duplicating effort. So it doesn't make any sense to hold more than one target date fund in the portfolio. And then they say this, which I would heartily disagree with. It says, Vanguard data show that more than 30% of participants use more than one TDF or a target date fund or a target date fund in tandem with other investment funds. These approaches could prove harmful, according to experts. What's an expert? I mean, wait a minute. Who is determining what is an expert in regards to this, and are they really an expert, would be my question, since TDFs are meant to as an all-in-one investment product. Now, here's the problem. What did I say earlier? That they're very heavy in one asset category, which is large and growth companies, which would have served you very, very well in the recent few years. But long run, if we look at the 1970s, it would have been terrible not having as much international. It would have been terrible not having as much small cap. In the vast majority, in 83% of 20-year periods, in 83%, I mean, we're talking most of the time here, it would have been not good not to have more small cap exposure. And these funds, by and large, have no more than 5 to 10% of their portfolio in small company stocks. You know, so if you look at them by design, they're not really all that well designed. And then you look at international versus U.S., most of it's U.S., you know, because we have this bias toward U.S. companies. And in the 1970s, that wouldn't have been good. 1980s, that wouldn't have been good. 90s, it would have been just fine. 2000s, it wouldn't have been good at all, because you had a lost decade, no returns whatsoever in U.S. markets. And then again, like I said just recently, that would have been just fine. But, you know, all of a sudden, are we saying, for some reason, oh, you know what, you know, small too, but international hasn't done as well as large, and small hasn't done as well as large either, right? So are we now to say, oh, you know what, small companies haven't had as high a return as large over the past 5 years, so, you know what, I'm feeling fairly charitable, and so are other investors around the world, and we just are willing to let these small companies and these international companies use our money for nothing. You know, and, well, Paul, what do you mean by that? I mean, you think about it, why do you invest? You're letting people use your money, right? Well, what do you want in return for letting them use your money? Returns. So if you are saying, let's avoid international, let's avoid small companies, let's avoid value companies, which 96% of the time do better historically in 20-year periods, all of a sudden, are we now saying, oh, these companies don't have to pay to use our money anymore, or we're going to let them use it, but we're going to charge them less, so to speak. It's the same thing in reality. It doesn't make any sense. It's illogical to say that all of a sudden the paradigm has changed completely and it's a new world we're living in. So in essence, a lot of times I will take somebody's 401k and I will typically try to build a portfolio with their 401k. I'll look at other funds that they give access to. It's getting harder now because what I'm finding in 401ks is that they're limiting the choices because they don't want to confuse you. And we don't want a confused investor, so we don't give them, and a confused investor, I agree, is bad. But the way they're saying that you're confused is you got too many choices. I say you're confused because nobody's really educating you. That's my humble view on the whole thing. But in reality, because they're underrepresenting small companies in the target date funds and the international funds, sometimes I have been known to use the target date funds for investors, for clients. And what I will do is I'll add in what's missing. I'll add in small caps. I'll add in international. I'll add in small international if they've got it or something like that, because that's almost never in the portfolios whatsoever, period, in a sentence. So you do this, and they're saying that's a mistake. I say, no, it's calculated on my part, because of the fact that these portfolios are so poorly diversified. And, you know, the problem is when you have a poorly diversified investor, they're taking more risk and they're not getting paid to take it. That's a problem. That's a problem, you know, because, you know, you can get down the road and you have a portfolio that's largely U.S. stocks. And, you know, you could be talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And depending on the time period, how long, could be millions of dollars difference in accumulation. But the reality of it is because all the fund companies are doing it, they're not likely to be held accountable because of the fact that everybody does it. You know, it's everybody's driving, you know, 70 miles per hour in a 60 or in a 55. So since everybody's doing it, nobody gets pulled over. And, you know, it's just the way it is in the fund company world as well. All right, Paul Winkler, you're listening to the Investor Coaching Show. I'll be back right after this on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Till next week, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.